All right, thanks everybody for coming, cramming into this tiny room on a hot day. But with all this brain power, I'm sure some of you can figure out when open source started. Right. Reel back. It was before Firefox, before...
Stone Tools.
Only
computers?
Stone Tools.
Stone Tools, okay. Date?
Oh,
roughly.
About 40,000 BC.
Okay.
On Thursday.
On Thursday.
Okay, so... Need a calendar then, Joe.
So some of us would say that before Stone Tools there were painted handprints on cave walls. The connection between open source and art goes back a ways. Goes back so far we don't call it open source when we talk about the artistic pedigree. Many people think that it started with Eric Raymond or folks like Richard Stallman. I've got a quote up here. This is from the Open Art Network, an early project of Stillwater that... like to think of as predating Creative Commons, by John Cage in 1969, American composer. Computers are bringing about a situation that's like the invention of harmony. Subroutines are like chords. No one would think of keeping a chord to himself. You'd give it to anyone who wanted it. You'd welcome alterations of it. Subroutines are altered by a single punch. We're getting music made by man himself, not just one man. 1969, okay? Now, excuse the sexist language, we're talking about someone who's imagining the emergence of participatory media and in fact is participating in it long before or just on the verge of the point at which computers can be imagined to be creative. So a lot of what John and I do at Stillwater is to think about ways that we can leverage newer technologies to have that same level of creativity imagined and practiced earlier by artists. The myth of the sort of solitary genius working in a studio, well, it had some traction in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, but it's pretty much non-existent before then and non-existent since. And what we find now with the emergence of online creativity is that everyone and his dog or cat can make a lolcat or some other kind of creative effort and post it on a website. So many curators and museum types, this strikes fear into their heart. They can't imagine... not just how to evaluate that stuff, but how to even view all of it. You know, there's so much creativity going around in tweets and Flickr photos being passed back and forth. And so they think, well, they really get nervous and they kind of retract and say, well, we need a gatekeeper and there's real culture and then there's all this silly Web 2.0 culture. And one of the things we do in Stillwater is to say, well, no, let's use network tools to find and filter through that online culture. And maybe we can crowdsource creativity. Find the Leonardos among the lolcats. So one of the tools that we use to do this is a Lolinardo. There you go. Careful, you'll start something. One of the tools we use to do this with is called the pool. John has been instrumental in the pool from the beginning. I'll let him explain it by showing it.
The pool is this big massive text over here that you see. The idea behind the pool is that it's a way to gather projects together. Most of them are net-based, but they aren't necessarily. And try to track the development process and try to get multiple people engaged on these artworks. So, like I said, right now you see this big massive text. The short version of it, there's a lot of data going on here. The things that people in the community like float up to the top. So these are the highest ranking projects. The things that are ranked most often move over to the right. And so the most reliable, highest rated projects are up in this area. And these ratings can come in at several different stages of the project. Just to give you an example, this is one that you can see is fairly well rated, but definitely has a lot going into it. So each stage is a different piece of the project. You have a global intent, which is just what you want to do with it. Just say a paragraph, and this is the idea behind it. And then going deeper into it, you get into the approach phase, which is starting to firm things up a little bit, and then actual releases of the project itself. So, as you can see, this one, one of the nice things about the pool is this tracking phase, so that you can see how the project develops. If you look at the different stages here, it gives you a little description of what's going on at each one, and start to work on an actual working website. That's always a good start. But at the global level, you can see that it's reviewed, and this is where those ratings came from that I just talked about. And it further breaks down each of those stages into a couple of different dimensions: conceptual, perceptual, technical. Does it actually work? Does it look good? Does it have a strong idea or concept behind it? And these ratings are all coming from other people, from other artists who have contributed something inside the pool. So this is really a mapping of offline networks into an online space and trying to smooth out some of the issues with them as far as making it more project-centric rather than a personality cult, which sometimes happens. Couple of other nice things that you can see through here are relationships between different projects. So the pipeline has predecessor campus calendar, and you can actually graph those out if you go back through here. So you can see the entire lineage of a project and where it fits into the entire ecosystem of the pool. You can see that, well, we were influenced by these other projects over here, and you can go back multiple generations. But what we eventually ended up with was this pipeline project that people seem to like. Just a couple of other quick hits. I don't want to go too much into it. I think most of it I want to leave for questions. But one other interesting way to look at this data is you can change the way that it's graphed, and you can find some interesting correlations. Right now, it's sort of legible as far as legible gets when you've got 200 words randomly thrown up on the screen. But we can make it more accurate so that now you can see that not only is the pipeline, was it before, rated fairly high and all the way over the right, now it really is compared to everything else. And this sort of curve is what we tend to find depending on where it doesn't matter what the ratings criteria are, it tends to float into this. So you can change between, okay, so this is an overall graph. What if you just look at the concepts of the different projects? You can change those around and it gives you a different view of it. And concept tends to map fairly close to overall, but once you start getting down into some different relationships, like technical approval versus conceptual, then you can start to see, well, this is an interesting way of looking at the data. What is both technically and conceptually good? Well, there's only a couple of things, really. Most of it tends to sort of melt into the middle, and then all of these over here don't have a technical rating. Like I said, the reviews are split out into different categories, so not all projects necessarily have a rating in each category. But that's basically it. There's a couple of different pools. This is the art pool. There's also one that's intended for code that we just launched not long ago. And also reference pools, so that when you have an outside artwork that wasn't developed by somebody who's actually participating in the pool, you can still feed it into this reference stream, the relationship stream. Well, not for that project. There we go. So you can still feed it in here even though it wasn't developed, so that gives you a much better ability to really track where these ideas come from, not just the ideas but also the technology behind it, when you can go between the code reference pool and an art creation pool, that sort of thing. I think that's the 10-minute tour. It took about 2 minutes.
One other thing that might be helpful, since there's so many Creative Commons types in the room, is to try to add on an approach or release and show them the license picker.
Sure.
Can we try? You'll have to be at the past the intent stage, so you could even probably add it on to.
Let's see. Okay, so this is a work that I did that isn't very impressive, but it's by me, so I don't feel bad adding something onto it. Okay, so I'm at an approach stage, and I want to add a release to it. So you can go in here and fill out these basic forms, but the part that you're probably more interested at is the license section, which I guess you can kind of see up there. You have a couple of different freedoms here. One, you can choose any option that you want out of these lists of common licenses. Or if you're not happy with those, you can create your own license based off of one of these. So if I want to start out with lesser GPL, but I want to make transformations be allowed instead of share alike, I can do that on a almost line item basis. Or even beyond that, you can add your own custom terms in here. So these artworks, even though, yeah, that's a better view. So as you can see there, it goes all the way from all rights reserved to complete public domain, and anything in between is viable.
And if you pick something by the terms that just happens to coincide with a license, it'll identify that license for you. So you can say, oh, that's what I meant, the open art license, or the lesser GPL, or whatever it might be. All right. So that's the pool. And I should, the only qualification I make to John's statement is that when we talk about art, we're really talking about a very general term, almost in the sense of prior art, because there are lots of applications and designs and political activism and proposals like that in there that are creative, and so they're considered as part of the art pool. What I'm going to show you is something a little different, targeted not so much to creators as critics, people who write about creativity and how they get to know each other. And right now, if you're an academic, those of you who in this room who are, you know that it sucks to try to publish in academic journals if you're a network person, because networks are all about, you know, twittering with each other and dialogue and connection and serendipity. An academic journal is about putting in a paper about, you know, YouTube that then's out of date 3 years later when it comes out in a dead tree journal. And maybe you've got these great journals at Harvard that don't do that. But as an academic myself, I found it very frustrating to work with the world of publishing. And even if you go to the extreme of, okay, well, I'm going to become digital and I'm going to use PowerPoint, well, we all know how social that is. You say, well, I'm going to my department. I'm lucky. I've got this university department that archives all my papers for me in an institutional repository. Great. Well, try to find those with Google. Google can't find a lot of dark web that's hidden inside databases. And even if you could find, you write your paper on Cezanne and someone tries to Google for nude bathers, I don't think your paper will be at the top. So what do we do if we're new media scholars and writers? How do we get our work out there and use serendipity to find each other? Well, here's an essay that tries to do that. Not the essay itself, although I'm harping on the same why art should be free theme. This essay is built with something called Thought Mesh. And it has the traditional sort of left-hand nav bar, which you can click and look through different parts of. It has a next and previous button. So far, so dull. Okay, so the essay is just broken up into parts, screen size, kind of chunkable reads. The cooler part is the tag navigation. We're somewhat familiar with this from blogs and so forth. This is a little bit different. It does allow you to look through a particular part of a site, like, okay, how much of this has to do with art? Surprise, everything. How much has to do with art and law? Oh, two pieces there. Okay, I get the idea. And those excerpts are all happening within this. So if I wanted to find out about artist property, it'll jump right to that place. I can also do other fun stuff, which I won't show. But the cool part is when you go to Lexia's Out. Excerpts Out says, not look at this essay, things that have to do with art, but things that have to do with other essays meshed around the web. Okay, so we're not talking about the same site here. And just to prove that, I will close up on the, look at that, a location bar, right, at 3.org. Okay, so I'm on one set website called 3.org looking at a certain essay. Well, let's say I'm interested in other essays that are out in the rest of the web. Well, James Leach wrote something, Nora Wardrop Pruin wrote something. Let's make it more specific. I'm going to add two tags, art and property, art and, let's see, what should I pick? Ownership. James Leach. Okay, so here's an essay that has to do with very similar themes to this one. And I'm going to click on that. Boink. Now I've jumped to a different website. Oh, it's University of Cambridge. Isn't that interesting? That's the other Cambridge. And I can see that the URL is different. It happens to be hosted at usc.edu, even though it claims to be University of Cambridge. So those of you who know anything about AJAX and these kind of technologies that allow you to pull in data in the middle of other applications might recognize this as something rather unusual, which is that it's a project that lets you basically go outside of a website and link to other essays on other websites. So this is very different from just having a blog that has tags, for example. It's jumped me right to a place where there is a kind of other descriptions about art and ownership. I can also jump to other tags on this site, and I see, introduction. I can go to read his essay, or again, I can jump out to other excerpts. Now, you'll notice on here that it does something a little bit different, which is that it's assuming you're looking only for the University of Cambridge, something called Creative Research in the Arts and Social Sciences. This is a particular submesh, if you will, of all of the meshed essays. You can create communities, clusters, journals, whatever you want to call them, that allow you to only search within a certain group, in this case, University of Cambridge. But heck, I didn't find anything in University of Cambridge, so I'm going to look for all meshes. And, oh, okay, there's a lot more. And I can pick one of those and go over there. Okay, now I'm on a different website, and I'm reading Native Eyes Online Learning Project, blah, blah, blah. And I can go and snoop around there. I can also go to the main Thought Mesh site and see what the latest tagged essays are and all that good stuff. In particular, I see that the National Poetry Foundation just launched an NPF mesh. This, again, is an example of the creation of a single kind of journal or mesh, submesh of the entirety. And you can see they got lots of articles already. And I can go through and see what their most common tags are. And I can look for more or fewer. But if I go down to really few ones, I see that lots of people are talking about erotic space and sometimes John Ashbery. Okay. So both of these projects are really meant to find the needle in a haystack for creators and critics. People are thinking creatively about culture at large and sometimes online culture. There's a lot more to be said, but I think that's a good stopping point. And we'd love to have questions or thoughts from folks out there. And I should mention before I let other people talk that although Wendy would probably deny it, she's been involved, Wendy Seltzer, in a number of these projects, often as an early adopter and sometimes as a consultant, and helped us work with the licensing, license picker and other attributes of the projects. Doc, you had something.
A very mundane question. I tried to sign up for the pool.
Mm-hmm.
Is my username my first name, my last name, or my email address?
It's your last name and first name with a number afterward, which is how many Searle's docs there are. It's probably 01.
So it's assigned to me somehow.
Yeah, and it's in your email. It should
be. Oh, it's in my email. Okay,
yeah.
Never mind.
Okay.
Or it should be shortly. At least.
I just tried to sign up.
While
okay, good. Yeah.
So does Thomas read PDFs?
Not yet.
I
can go through the process of creating an essay, but rather than bore you with that, there is a automatic software that digests your text and picks out the most common words and suggests those as tags. You have complete freedom as an author to change those and customize them. Mm-hmm. We are working on the idea of, right now you essentially get a series of sections that you fill in, cutting and pasting from some word, some proprietary word processing software that will not be named. But in the future, we're hoping that you just take the entire thing and upload it. And that's actually something that Wendy has been pushing us to do.
Yeah, because at the same time as this might find dark corners of the web that are unindexed by Google, like, you know, a lot of scholarly articles that are already out there in one form or another are in PDF primarily.
Sure.
And so wouldn't want to close off one whole avenue while opening up another.
So I want to ask a question that has come up often in conversations that I've had with John, which is, as a lawyer thinking about copyright, I tend to push toward public domain, toward fewest restrictions on creative works, because people can take from the public domain and reuse them as they'd like. And so I say to John, why don't you license everything, or encourage people to license everything in the pool, public domain, no strings attached, put things out there on the web where anyone can find them and reuse them. And John pulled me to thinking a lot more about relationships and other values.
So your question sounded like I haven't convinced you yet, so I'll try again. You know, that we tend to think, especially when we talk about openness and, you know, freedom, of two poles. There's copyright lockdown, which totally stinks, and then there's information wants to be free, in Stuart Brand's coinage. And I think those two poles were good for the early internet, right? Well, the second one was good for the early internet. The first one's never been good for the internet. But and we think of things like copyleft as a solution to the issue of sort of misuse or commercialization or co-optation of other people's culture. But one of the things that really bugged me and bugged John early on, I know, because you were one of the people who suggested some of the new licenses, is that you've got your MP3, you know, your brother in his garage band, and you know, you're the lead singer, and you put it online for other people to use. And even if you put a Creative Commons license on it that says share alike or attribution or whatever, it's really hard to find who uses that MP3. You've hosted it to your MySpace blog. It shows up in someone's, you know, video as a soundtrack, and that might be completely legal for you, but how do you know that they've done that? You know, there's basically no connection back to the original use, and good luck finding these reuses on Google. You know, you can create an alert and you can look for stuff, but if it's a video and a soundtrack, it's scrolling by in a screen that's, you know, pixelated text on one of the, you know, video frames. You're not necessarily going to find it in the places where you might look for it. So this, in contrast to some of the work that Wendy and others have done on the understanding of native cultures in how culture is shared. We went back to stone tools, right? Okay, so that's folks who preceded us, sustainable, evolved, indigenous creatures, who did a great job of sharing culture. And when you go back to indigenous cultures today, as we have with the cross-cultural partnership that I hope Wendy will talk about a little more later, you learn that the way they share culture isn't just letting it go, but neither is it stamped with a copyright notice. Because culture often exists in these communities as a pretext for social connection. And if they give you something, it's not for it to just disappear into your baggage and you take off to another continent, that's the end of it. It is the beginning of a relationship. So why would I post my MP3 online with whatever criteria are attached in whichever Creative Commons license or GPL variant I choose and never find out who uses it? That's a profound missed opportunity for social connection. And that's why we've been at work on things like what we call the registration license term, where someone, for example, who uses the pool is asked to use something from the pool. Go ahead, be my guest. But go back and register your reuse. So we can do things like John showed you of mapping the genealogy of that creativity. Yeah?
Yeah, I guess I'm interested in the structure and the curves that you discovered when you came up with this way of graphing with approval, overall conceptual approval or technical approval. Did you find that there were shapes that art production and its merits took that you found like a bell curve shape that certain items were pushed out, or that there was that clustering that you had? And what might that mean about art production if we find ourselves kind of clustered at the center with only a few breakout works that people really like?
We wanted to call it the bell curve because John discovered it, but that name was taken. Why don't you just show a couple of
can show you examples. Ari showed you technical versus conceptual, but perceptual, this is mostly talking about look and feel type of things. You can see it's kind of the same. conceptual versus perceptual. Again, kind of the same. It's one of the things that tends to show up in here is that there's a little bit of a bias in the reviewers in that if they like a project overall, then each of the component ratings will be higher than it necessarily would, than the project necessarily deserves. So that's why you get this sort of linear direction like this. But in general, that first one, let me reset.
I've actually got the another chart
on
the screen. We might want to compare them. So that's project development versus approval. So basically, how many little boxes in that version stream there have been? There've been like, you know, an intent and four approaches and 20 releases or whatever. That would be way over to the right. If it was just like, well, I have an idea, but they didn't get any further, it would be way over to the left. And that's got that kind of curve as well, suggesting that. I know, John, did you want to talk about that particular curve?
I think there's kind of a feedback loop going on there, just because as projects get more and more approval, people will tend to work on them more. And also, the opposite is true. If a project has more work that's gone into it, then probably people are going to like it more. It's not going to break randomly on them.
We can also change, instead of project development, we can do number of contributors and change the axes. So this is a totally different kind of parameter, and yet it has very similar kind of curve, right? So more contributors tend to create a better project. That's not always true. Obviously, this project up here and this project got very high remarks, even though they had few contributors. But you still get that strange kind of asymptotic triangle, where over time, you know, more people tend to produce something that's a little bit better than average. What else?
Maybe the contributors are rating it highly.
Yes, exactly. Unfortunately, the pool prevents you from doing that. Not that people haven't tried.
Well, they're drawn to contribute to it because it's already a good thing.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. So I think what you said, John, about the feedback loops, that's number of relationships, which is sort of the same, but not as easy to... This one, it's a bit skewed because someone created a project based on trying to make a relationship with every other project in a certain class. And so they, literally, this one, it broke my grapher, right? Let's see, map relationships. You know, if you go back one generation, so people try to screw with the pool, right? There's too many things. It's just insanely, anyway. So.
Project itself is open source.
The project meaning the pool?
The pool and dot mesh are open source.
That's right. So they're all, you know, PHP, JavaScript, that kind of stuff. You can certainly use it at any time. It's free for someone who wants to register. But if you wanted to hack it, we can show you how we have it built afterward.
Yeah.
Oh, let's see. I think. Project development is a good one. Yeah. You can also do things like, you know, versus date. And, you know what? We don't have... Is this the full scope? No.
What? Oh, yeah.
I was only showing the last 200 projects, so you get a little more feeling of it if you show all the projects. It'll probably also break my browser. There's, 800 projects now and 1,500 reviews or something like that. Yeah.
Clarifying
a little bit about what you mean by project and what
are these things
that we're talking about
for those of us who aren't looking,
people who are
into
it. Are these
art projects or are these like
source
code?
It's this pool is mostly art projects, but like John said, we're using art as a very broad term here. Some of them are
just... So like Pipeline was an online calendar. It was basically like group share, groupware. And but you also have things like iChurch is a website that allows churches and other religions to place to post services, sermons as podcasts, blah 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 blah. The Glass Bead Game is a sort of what it sounds like, a new version of the HESA piece. The Walls Have Ears is sort of like Twitter. Anarchy Mud is a ruleless text-based community. this Divi is like a sort of like a Facebook variation. So there's lots of different projects, most of which have some online component, but they don't necessarily. There's a guerrilla graffiti car where you drive around and project graffiti on buildings. So it's fairly wide-ranging.
And the pool is in there.
Oh, and did you want to show like a code? Did you want to show like the code?
Yeah,
pool or something.
But there is sort of a SourceForge component to it in that you can also put in. Like I said, we just launched this code snippets that other people can reuse. Like this is the Ajax shell, which is driving the pool, and I put that in under. I don't remember what rights, but apparently that license was what I felt like that day. So other people can come in here and they'll be able to reuse it. Most of this is actually from me, but it, like I said, once it fills up a little bit more, then I would expect a lot of those art projects in the other pool to start drawing out of here.
Pointless Alert isn't doing too well there in the graph.
Well, you know.
People don't like that.
Yeah.
I think more on what Zach said, I know you just launched it. Is there going to be any provision for recording somehow simply who looks at something, even if they don't review it, if they hover over it, if they take the time to read it? Because I'm looking at it, I mean, it's really neat, but half the stuff is so obscured by overlap and whatnot that it's illegible. And so, in terms of cognitive biases, you might be more likely to go look on, click on, read whatever, something that you can just read.
Yeah.
And so I'm just wondering if that's going to contribute to the reinforcing effect you're seeing rather than any actual evaluation of something's merits.
It can, but the view that you're seeing up there isn't actually the view that is used most often. Most times people will cut down a little, on what you see a little bit, and you can filter out. So if I filter out by just subjects, call it interaction, which is probably going to be fairly common, but that starts to clear it out a little bit. And then also that graphing panel that I showed you before.
I just changed it actually to the most legible
view
okay. Over here on this slide. So there's some. I think it's a good. It's an important thing for us to think about, and we haven't really solved it completely. We've done some headway in terms of the filters and so forth. People typically often go to the pool with a filter already as part of the link. That helps a little bit, but it is an issue we need to think about. That's actually one of the proposals that someone made to the pool, which is a. You know, if you imagine sort of a non-Euclidean geometry where the as you move your cursor, that part of the space expands, you know, and kind of bigger.
You could have like a magnifying glass square as your cursor.
That's probably more practical. Yeah. Good suggestions.
You wanted to talk a little bit about the partnership agreement. This is a subject that I've brought up in some Berkman discussions, but one of the other times that I've worked with John was with a group he convened that brought together digital artists and digital natives of one type, indigenous people from the the Wabanaki group, along with some of us folks like lawyers and anthropologists, to think about what do we do when we share knowledge that seem to get at some of these issues of networks and relationships in interesting ways.
Okay, so I brought up connected knowledge-knowledge.net. And if you just read some of the questions there, it kind of gives us a sense of what the organization is about. The idea that there can be such a thing as responsible reuse, which is something that we kind of give lip service to in the usual world of open licensing and, you know, attribution and so forth, but we don't really think about what is it. We say, well, you know, Creative Commons gives you the right to use it, and then it's up to you to be responsible, or of course we want you to use it responsibly. It's sort of like those, you know, Budweiser commercials that say, drive responsibly at the bottom. Well, okay, what is responsible reuse? What constitutes behavior that is appropriate and ethical between people who are using each other's culture? What does sovereignty mean outside of nation states? That would seem to be like totally left field question. How does that have to do with, you know, reusing an MP3? Well, one of the things that we've come to a conclusion about as part of the conversations that started by Jolene Blay and myself and Wendy and native folks we work with, Gisitanamok and Mi'kmahan, are how can you kind of take back your personal sovereignty so that you have the ability to treat with someone else and establish a relationship between them that's not governed by some, you know, national relationship, because frankly, you know, the relationship between, say, the United States government and the Wabanaki Confederacy sucks. It's a disaster that's marked by centuries of betrayal. So if we're going to establish ethical connections, we go back to the model of kinship that we find in indigenous cultures. And that means establishing a certain level of sovereignty that comes from individuals or small collectives rather than I'm here on as an American and you're here as a Wabanaki. How we reconcile access to information and the right of privacy, another area that Wendy's very interested in, and it's come increasingly under, you know, to public attention with, you know, Google and China and so forth. And networks of trust. How do we build networks of trust? Well, as much as we'd like to think that there is a technical solution, ultimately these things have to be, customized to the particular case. And again, as Wendy keeps reminding me, the documents, the instruments that you create, like as one I'll show you in a moment, are not really so important as kind of legal documents by themselves. They're a heuristic. They're a spur to getting you to the kind of dialogue you have to have to have responsible reuse. And so maybe one thing we could look at quickly is the template. Boom, boom, boom. Okay, so this is a cross-cultural partnership that really is something that Wendy and to some extent an anthropologist named James Leach, who's taken a strong interest in this, in his own work, created as a response to the question of how can we act ethically. And ultimately the problem was Euro-American law has no room for ethics, right? It's all ethic neutral. It's all instrumental or it all works. And so that's why these contracts and the EULAs and so forth that you end up signing the bottom line, there's no way you could possibly read all the text because all of it is trying to describe every last particular situation which something would happen. But you just can't do that when you walk into the rainforest and say, we'd like to use your medicinal herbs. Is that okay? You're not going to be able to write a contract that specifies every contingency because you have no idea what an Amazonian's culture says about those herbs, and they have no idea what your culture says about contract law. Instead, what we needed was something that would provide a moral force behind it, expectations of ethical behavior across cultures between people. It wasn't all spelled out in legalese and some tiny fine print at the bottom of a contract. And Wendy pointed out that there is a paradigm for this in American law. It's called partnership. And Wendy can speak to it much more eloquently than I, but we decided to use the notion of a partnership as a template for starting a dialogue between lots of different conditions in which one person wants something from another and they're not sure how to do it ethically. Okay? So, you know, someone from an NGO or a pharmaceutical company parachutes into the rainforest and says, we want to market the yucca plant. How do they do that, even if they want to do it responsibly? Right now they have two choices. They just steal it, which is the historical model that's proven effective, or they go in and say, well, who has the copyright to this? We'll negotiate with you. Well, how do you tell the Yanomami that, you know, who has the copyright? This is ridiculous. The notion of owning a plant or even owning intellectual property to them is an anathema. So instead of that model, you say, well, all right, let's sit down and think about what you could get out of this exchange and what we could get out of it. And there's lots of very specific kind of, you know, legal things. It could include sharing stories or oral heritage, creating a documentary film to advocate for an indigenous group, distributing native medicines to the larger public, researching collaborations in art and technology. Okay, it's not just about us versus indigenous people. It's also about artists and industry, right? Like, you know, Bell Labs famously in the 60s had Robert Rauschenberg and other artists go in and work with engineers from, you know, what's now AT&T. Cool. But you know what? They had very different expectations about what that collaboration was going to be like. The artists are like, hey, I want to do a dance show, or I want to have an exhibition. And the engineers are like, I need to publish in a research journal, or I need to have something that looks like a phone come out of this, because I work for Bell Labs. Right? So to get those two cultures to talk to each other, they need some kind of cross-cultural agreement. It talks about the usual stuff, prior work, all these things that you lawyers would find fascinating. Differential benefits. A book might draw on native experience to promote awareness of their cultural distinctiveness. The academic gets a book credential to put on his or her CV. A research project might give an engineer a new technical challenge, and the artist might get some tool that they need to make some new interactive installation. So they might get divergent results out of the partnership, and that's okay. I won't go through all of it, but one of the more interesting things is choice of law, right? Because we all assume, well, it's go to a court, right? Well, do you? Or do you resort to the native law? And remedies and breaches and so forth are taken care of through that system. What is the preferred arena in which legal disputes or conflicts about the partnership take place? So Wendy could speak more to it, but that's the emphasis. We've had many conferences. We have a number of partnerships now under kind of in process where they're building these things out. But we're very excited about this idea that you can build trust through mechanisms that encourage a kind of responsible reuse.
It seems like this is a really good kind of model when you already have some level of trust, but how do you get to a place where you have that trust and where the power relationships are, if not balanced, then at least acknowledged in such a way that people can bargain in good faith?
Ceremony. We'll see if I can find something that answers that question. Let's see, where is it? Distant neighbor protocol. Well, I could just describe it. Okay. So one of the things that that we've innovated out of this cross-cultural partnership agreement is the notion of the distant neighbor protocol. Academics are always trying to study something far away, especially anthropologists, right? No anthropologist goes and turns around and says, I'm going to study the culture of the Berkman Center. You know, they're like, well, often, you know, really, well, okay, some might. There's a lot of material here, right? You could get like something really juicy, right? But instead, they're like, I'm going to go to Papua New Guinea. So, you know, or the whatever. So how do they keep that from being a sort of telescopic, you know, kind of tourism, you know, exoticism, that kind of thing? How do they establish trust with someone who's far away? Because that's essentially your question. So what we came up with we had a conference last year in Banff of the Connected Knowledge Series. And we said, let's brainstorm a way to have this work. And what we decided was a number of kind of premises. One is that indigenous people, and we're generalizing here, often want a kind of, there's certain knowledge that they often refer to as sacred, which they don't just share openly. Some knowledge they'll share openly, and other knowledge is more private, to use the terms of American law. Sacred knowledge is often connected to the land, it's often connected to people, so it tends to be very local. And they'll share it with trusted people. Indigenous people also are just about everywhere. They have very good networks. Surprisingly, the North American continent, for example, people traveled from one end to the other, East Coast to West Coast, long before the arrival of Columbus. They weren't these like isolated villages as we kind of imagine from our American history books. Furthermore, what they most want to be, what many Native people claim to need is to be seen by often the people who walk by them every day, right? So you can walk by a homeless person every day on your way to work and not see them. Right. Well, how do you see those Native people who might have issues? For example, here we are in Massachusetts, and Kisitanamuk, who is a person who we work with a lot. Let's see if I can find a picture of him. Okay, so Kisitanamuk is a very important a member of our All right, and he's a Wampanoag, so I'll just find him using Thought Mesh. There we go. Okay, there he is. Kisitonomic is a very important member of our connected knowledge group. His people are from Mashpee, from what we now call Massachusetts, right? So there are, and there's a few of them left, and they're the people who greeted the pilgrims and gave them a nice, you know, Thanksgiving dinner. Well, what's left of them? Most people here have no idea where they are, what their concerns are, what issues relate to them. So what we do is the Harvard professor says, I want to go study, you know, someone in, you know, the Cree or something in Banff, in Alberta. And they say, they go to a website, this is the distant neighbor protocol, not yet implemented, but we have it sketched out. They go to a website where they learn more information about the Cree. Oh, cool, I want to go visit them, and I need an introduction. I want to learn some of their sacred knowledge, some of the stuff they keep private, the culture that they don't share with most people. Say, okay, well, if you want to learn more about them, we will send you a contact, click here, right? You send in your credentials, so forth. Well, the contact, it turns out, is not Brian Kayu or someone from the Cree, it's someone from your backyard. It's Kisitonomok, who lives on Cape Cod, okay? And he says, I happen to know some Cree people, and I'd be willing to make an introduction. And you're like, great, okay, well, I'd like to get started. And he's like, well, okay, let's hold off a moment. Let's get to know each other first. Why don't you come out to where we are, on, you know, near Truro or whatever, and we'll have a chat. And he establishes trust with you, right? Maybe they do a sweat, maybe you smoke a pipe, maybe you just have coffee, you know, whatever. Play cards. Somehow, you establish trust with Kisitonomok. He then feels that he can pass on the introduction to Brian, the Cree, who's in Alberta. What has happened in the process? You got your introduction. You're going to get your paper in a journal someday. But what he's gotten is you to see him in your backyard, right? So instead of this telescopic kind of, you know, exoticism, you're forced to deal with someone who might have land rights issues or casino bills or other things that relate to your immediate surroundings. That's the distant neighbor protocol, and it's a mechanism for establishing that contact. Well, I'm by far not the right person to go into depth about native senses of sovereignty, but and I could try to video chat in Kisitonomok, but I think we're running low on time, so I'll try to do my best. I don't think there is the sense of individual in certainly the Wabanaki and many of the native cultures that I've encountered, as I may have glibly passed on. Every individual is defined by a network of relationships. But it is not a sense of collective in the sense that we say, I am a fellow of the Berkman Center, or I am a student at Harvard, or I am an American. That's the model of hierarchies. You're either inside or you're outside. I think in more native cultures, it's a sense of connection. The way we would say, I am more or less connected on, you know, AOL Instant Messenger or Facebook or whatever. That's a little more the model of networks. And so trust comes about once, and sovereignty, once you have established enough connections with others in the network so that you are elevated, not yourself, but by the people you're connected to a level of respect. And obviously the people who have the most respect in those cultures are often the elders because they've made the most connections. And oftentimes before sharing any kind of knowledge like that, people like Kisitonomok, who is an elder, will seek out other elders. And more elderly than himself. It's not the right adjective, but you know what I mean. And then they would ask them. And there are differences. That sounds a lot like a hierarchy, but there are differences. For example, the Wabanaki Confederacy, of which Kisitonomok is a member, originally had a model of what we might view as sort of similar to our court system. Issues that were troubling between local groups would go up to a level that would be like a clan council, and then up above that, and there'd be intertribal councils and so forth. And we say, well, that's just like the, you know, kind of tribal councils that people have today and managed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Well, they're very different, because at that level, as Kisitonomok relates it, during that time, the higher up the chain you went, the less authority was handed down. Now, maybe the word authority is wrong, the less power over you. So if you went to immediate group who were the elders in the village, they'd have a lot of say over what happened in the village. But if you went up to the, you know, highest level of the Iroquois or Wabanaki Confederacy in the Council of Elders, they would make a recommendation, but it would give the local groups the jurisdiction still to make their own decision. That's the opposite of what happens here. The higher up you go in the chain, the more power you have. Now, they still had influence because they were elders. They were very respected. So to go against them is really hard because, well, they're there because they're respected. But it isn't the same kind of authority that's wielded by hierarchies. So it's very interesting. It's a very interesting question. I can't say I completely understand all aspects of it, but it does give me hope that there are alternatives to hierarchies when it comes to organized structures.
I think we can maintain our non-hierarchical conversation after the formal close to the discussion here, but I want to thank you very much for coming to share with us.
Thank you.